All right, continuing with the English Civil War. We ended last time with the execution of the Earl of Strafford, or also known as Wentworth. In hindsight, this was an important turning point in helping people think through the relationship of the king and the law. At the time, they didn't quite realize how significant this was, but it began to slowly dawn upon them as circumstances unraveled. And that thing that hadn't dawned upon them was whether the king could be held accountable to law by the people he ruled. And that was a foreign thought. It was not something that was just part of their vision. They couldn't see. So after the death of Strafford, Parliament continued to press its advantage forward with its reforms, and they abolished the Star Chamber. Remember, this is the king's court that he would stack with his people, and that would be where his cases that he wanted to bring against the people would be tried. And with the disbanding of this, or the abolishing of it, it meant that any case that the king brought to be adjudicated by law would have to come before the ordinary courts, where judges sat who were not beholden to him. He couldn't threaten them and release them from office. This undertaking rested upon the Magna Carta, which separated the executive from the judiciary. So they were, Parliament was trying to bring that back in, where you can't have the king who's going to try a case stack the court with the judges who are going to try and find a rule in his favor. And so Parliament was trying to apply the principles that were enshrined back in the Magna Carta. With the abolition of the Star Chamber, this in fact brought torture to an end. Torture where you could allow evidence ascertained through torture into a courtroom. That kind of stopped that back in that time in England. And the thinking of the parliamentarians behind the abolishing of the Star Chamber was because its judges have undertaken to punish where no law doth warrant. So they were carrying out law where there was no law. They were punishing. Parliament also declared the ship's money tax to be illegal. Remember that the king needed to expand his taxation, and so he just made everybody pay for a ship. And then in December of 1641, Parliament presented to the king the Grand Remonstrance, which was a long indictment on all the evils of his reign. However, still at this stage, this was prefaced by the assumption that these bad things that were done had come from the king receiving bad advice. There was still no direct line, you did this, you guilty, you should be found guilty before the law. Parliament was still struggling to embrace the idea that the king, as a king, could have broken the law. And so this was what was being worked out in their minds. So even as the people endured corruption, the hardships and the trauma of what the king's corruption and unleashing all these things upon them and all these dealings, and although they complained about their circumstances, they were stereotyped in how they thought about what the king could do. Rather than thinking about law and what was the legality of what was happening, they found themselves resting upon the escape hatch. It's the king, and so our reasoning about the subject stops there. Well, that's what the king did. We don't have any parameters to think beyond that. The scriptures tell us that you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And this is not only talking about being set free from the bondage of sin and guilt, but it has to do with the comprehensive freedom that the Messiah's kingdom has brought and secured for his followers. In Britain at this time, most of the people were enduring different aspects of the king's tyranny because they didn't know the truth, and therefore they didn't know how to obtain true freedom. They couldn't identify it, they couldn't recognize it, didn't know which direction they should go in, they couldn't pinpoint the ultimate cause of their bondage. And we need to realize that every generation faces the same dilemma, where they get brought into a position where their thinking is just flows from what they've been immersed in all the time. It flows from the culture that they've grown up in. It flows from the experiences that they've endured. It flows from their historical understanding and their own reasoning. Whether we like it or not, our present reality, our present is, and where we live and how we think about things, is inherited from the past. As the overused saying, does the fish know it's wet? This is who we are. This is where we've been raised and brought up. So a person born into 1600 England would have found themselves in a very real, established way of thinking and living. And as they grew up, they were constantly bombarded with the established norm in how to think about the king, about law. And also they were very capable defenders of the status quo, of how things were. Both theologians and politicians and people who reasoned, who defended the very thinking that was in establishment. It was there, and people then just, well, this is just how it is. And so people defended the notion that the king by necessity had to be above the law. We have to defend this. We have our own established, long-practiced ways of thinking about things. Even things which cause us to accept tyranny. Why would we accept tyranny? Well, because our thinking has been shaped in a certain way. We don't have any tyranny in the USA, do we? No. I suggest that we in the USA are living with one of the most destructive tools of tyranny ever conceived. It's my suggestion, you don't have to follow me. And I believe we don't even realize it. What is this tyrannical weapon that I'm thinking of? I'm not asking you to answer me. I'm suggesting to you that this incredible weapon of tyranny in our age that we kind of accept is income tax. The very word income tax. As soon as the civil government says that they are going to take X percent, I don't care what percent that is, X percent of your income, that's a huge tool of tyranny. Why? Because they have absolute access to every aspect of your being, your life, your existence, your actions, your they have a right to make sure that they are getting from you the right percentage of income that they have determined is legally theirs. It belongs to them. And so I've come to the conclusion when thinking about when Samuel was talking to the children of Israel about the oppression of the king they were asking for, that the 10 is not really significant. He's going to take from you 10%. I'm suggesting to you that the very idea of a percentage of your income, a percentage of what you earn going to the king, opens the door for tyranny. And I believe is a tyrant. And they can really turn you inside out, make sure you are not withholding something that they claim belongs to them. So maybe to a lesser degree, something like sales tax falls into the same thing. It has the same qualities about it, sales tax, because it suddenly means every single transaction that's ever done has to be recorded and carefully noted and dealt out. So for the same reasons. Winston Churchill, once there was a heated debate in Parliament between the Liberals and his party, and then they took a break, and he went to the restroom, and as he walked in, the Liberal champion guy was standing next to the urinal on one side, and it was this long urinal, and he walked right down to the other end to use it, and this guy said, "Hey, Winston, you know, there can be no hard feelings between us." And he said, "No, my problem is that every time Labour sees something big, they want to tax it." And so I tell that story because, first of all, because it's funny, and second of all, because it points to something that's incredibly important in our thinking, and that is almost an unquestioned acceptance of anything the state turns its attention to tax. We just kind of say, well, that's their right, that's their prerogative, they should just do it. And so we allow them to do it. I mean, what don't they tax? And we say, okay, well, it's kind of legitimate. You buy a second-hand car, and they'll evaluate the price of it, and decide how much tax you should pay on that. It's everything is taxable, and we're living in a generation that doesn't blink. In fact, it's kind of to be expected. Bitcoin needs to be taxed. It's the latest thing that the IRS is now thinking. We've got to tax Bitcoin. Everything you own is going to be taxed, and we want to know. We want to have complete control and knowledge about it. We might not be able to change things right now. There's no immediate short-term fix of that, where we've got ourselves to. But I think we can start to change our thinking about it. We can start to call tyranny tyranny for what it is, and start thinking and promoting, this is tyranny. And I can call it tyranny and still stay out of jail. But at least people, we start to question it and spread that understanding. This is tyranny. And it's, as the people in England failed to start to deal, we got to deal with the king. How do we think about him? We've got to, in the same way, deal with this area. Well, there are many areas in our day which I don't want to get into. I want to stay focused on Charles. When Charles's self-serving plans needed money, he merely expanded the ship's tax. We have to see our resignation to an acceptance of the everything you do and everything you turn taxation of our day, everything that is taxed in our day. We've got to see that in the same light as the way we should expect, or the way we today say England should have thought about the king. Because they couldn't bring themselves to challenge the idea of the king being under the law. They believed he was above the law, and that was their thinking stopped there. Okay, so Parliament presents Charles with a grand remonstrance, pointing out his faults, but without directly accusing him of anything bad. And about the same time, there was an uprising in Ireland, where the native Irish, together with the Roman Catholics, massacred newly settled English Protestants in the land. And the numbers hugely vary greatly. From 100,000 to 5,000 Protestants were massacred in Ireland. And this was, you know, churning things up with Charles, with the people in England, with Parliament. And Parliament passed, you know, they took a vote on the Grand Remonstrance then and passed it. And then they had it printed and distributed to the people. And Charles responded by ordering the arrest of 5 MPs and the 5 main people he thought. Pym was one of the guys, one of the main guys in that. So he said, we're going to arrest these men. And then he marched upon the House of Commons with 400 of his soldiers, armed soldiers. And he walked in there and said, I want these 5 men. Now, these 5 men had left, but the rest of the MPs were there. And he turned to the Speaker of the House and said, are the MPs here? Those 5 men, are they here? And this Speaker of the House, he fell at the King's feet at that point, and he said, may it please your Majesty, I have neither eyes to see nor tongue to speak in this place, but as the but as the House is pleased to direct me, whose servant I am here, and humbly beg your Majesty's pardon that I cannot give any answer than this. And basically he said, I can't answer you, but I ask for your mercy. And the king stormed out and then went to the city of London, to the aldermen of London, and said, hand over the 5 MPs. They weren't about to do that. And thus Charles departed and left London. That was the last time he was in London as a free man. He now left and went to set up his headquarters somewhere else. At this time, he started to prepare for war. He sent his wife, who was a French Roman Catholic lady, Henrietta Maria, to Holland with the crown jewels to purchase weapons and mercenaries. And what you got now is the splitting of the nation, splitting of families, splitting of villages, as people took sides, the royalists against the parliamentarian army. Robertson says that what is certain is that nobody went to war for a republic. And when Henry Martin first suggested one, he was immediately clapped in the Tower. He was immediately put in jail for suggesting a republic. So at this stage, there was no, Parliament was not seeking a republic. Parliament at that time drew up the terms upon which it required the king to rule in the future. There were 19 propositions proposing a constitutional monarchy in which power would be shared between king, the commons, at the House of Commons, and the lords. Parliament had the right to approve all ministers in the government. It said we have the right to approve the officers of the army and the senior judges. And Charles had to consent to parliamentary control of the army and the supervision of the church. And judges would take an oath to uphold the Magna Carta and the Petition of Right and could not be removed by the king. Charles basically said, get lost, I'm not doing that. And he said, the House of Commons was never intended for any share in government or the choosing of them that govern. So the king condemned these 19 propositions because they encouraged the common people to think that they might be equal with the men of his state. In other words, the thinking of the king was that such changes, this would lead to anarchy. It just couldn't be done, so he rejected it. So on August the 22nd, 1642, in a field outside Nottingham Castle, Charles declared war against his own people who chose to follow Parliament. This was a war about ideas, namely ideas about the source of law and its purpose. Charles claimed that the king was the source of law and therefore not under it, and that the law was for the purpose of carrying out his will. Parliament argued that the source of law was not the king and therefore he was under the law, and that the law was meant for the good and the protection of the people. So you had these two worldviews clashing and leading to armed conflict. The first battle between the opposing forces ended in a draw, with 3,000 men dead on the battlefield. And after the first year, the conflict was definitely tilting toward the royalists, and they had taken the advantage by winning a number of battles. Thus, in September 1643, shortly before his death by cancer, Pym, one of the main leaders of the parliamentary side, made an alliance with the Scots. But the Scots said, we will come and fight with you if you embrace the covenant, the Solemn League and Covenant, and make England a Presbyterian nation. The independents in Parliament were opposed to this, but the agreement was entered into, and the Scots gave about 20,000 men to the cause. Around this time, we see, too, the first change in fortunes as the royalist Prince Rupert, whose cavalry had up until this point been undefeated, was unexpectedly routed by the parliamentary cavalry commanded by two officers who had never fought together. Oliver Cromwell and Sir Thomas Fairfax had begun their sensational partnership, and they would go on to great battle victories, Cromwell demonstrating himself to be an amazing general. On June the 14th, 1645, Cromwell and Fairfax crushed the royalist infantry who had been left unprotected by their cavalry. Their cavalry had engaged with the parliamentary forces, and the parliamentary forces had dispersed, and the cavalry had undisciplined chased after, trying to catch the supply line of the parliamentarians, and the infantry was left but exposed, and Cromwell and Fairfax swung upon them and decimated them, killed 1,000 of the infantry, captured 5,000, and but also at the same time captured the king's baggage train. And in this baggage train was tons of the king's correspondence, which now was going to seal his fate. In this correspondence, it was seen that he had been writing to the leaders of the rebels in Ireland, hoping to bring these Roman Catholic forces to help him in England. He had already hired French mercenaries, but he was also plotting with the Queen to raise funds and forces from France. In return, he had promised toleration of Catholicism in England. You can imagine the English people, how they responded to that. He had to quote Robertson, been conspiring with the enemies of England to levy war with foreign troops against his own people. This was treason in anyone else. And if in anyone else, why not in the king? It was a question that no one dared to ask. And so at that stage, we were still in a difficult position. The king's remaining forces were mopped up in siege after siege of the royalist towns. And by April of 1646, Fairfax had surrounded Oxford, the king's last fortress. The king managed to disguise himself as a servant, and he escaped from the city. And he determined that he would receive better treatment from the Scots. And so on May the 5th, he surrendered himself to the Scottish army at Newark. Now, throughout this section of the Civil War, Charles had maintained a very hands-on leadership in the councils, in all the court martials, and in the field, which indubitably fixed him with what is now called command responsibility, namely liability in law for the criminal conduct of troops which he controlled or could have controlled had he wished. The rules of war were very clear at this stage. It wasn't like nobody understood. And it meant you don't slaughter civilians, you don't persecute civilians, you don't execute surrendered soldiers other than for provable in a court-martial case, proper case, provable war crimes that they might have been committing. You don't do that. So, but the royalist forces were constantly doing this, allowing rape and executing prisoners who were not guilty of war crimes. In quite remarkable contrast, the parliamentary forces were pretty restrained, and their godly generals were very severe on any of this kind of misconduct. If there was soldiers were guilty of pillage or rape, they were punished very harshly. One in every 10 adult males in Britain died in battle in this war, and there were several hundred thousand people who were caught in the collateral damage, so to speak, in the sieges and diseases and starvation that was a result of the war. So now, to give some historical context, in the midst of the Civil War, Parliament called upon the learned judicious theologians of the day to draw up a confession for worship, doctrine, government, and discipline of the Church. And so that was in 1643. So the Civil War was underway when Parliament shows its need and its understanding, and it puts an emphasis on, hey, we need a body of truth that we can subscribe to for the Church in England. And so they called the divines, and even intellectual later on writers who wouldn't necessarily have gone along with everything that the Westminster Confessions held and stated, have made comments like that gathering of men was the greatest gathering of learned people since the days of the apostle. I don't know if that's an exaggeration, but it was indeed an incredibly amazing time in history of having those kinds of people gathered together. So they met from 1643. I think the first printing of the Westminster was 1647. 1644, Samuel Rutherford published Lex Rex. He was one of the divines working in Westminster at the time, working on that on the sideline, and published his book. And so you've got those aspects developing. You've got the Scottish General Assembly saying there could be no hope of unity in religion till there be one form of ecclesiastical government. Okay, so Scotland is saying that. They've got this agreement with England, but that's Scotland's mindset. And so Scotland passes this Parliamentary Act setting up Presbyterian government as the national form of religion. Oliver Cromwell was not happy with that. And he sought to obtain an order from the House in England that a way be found for tender consciences who cannot in all things submit to the common rule which shall be established. What about those people who couldn't embrace Presbyterianism? He said, can't we make a clause for that? Bailey, one of the Scottish guys amongst the Westminster divines, he said that that sounded the alarm when Cromwell started to make this request. Because as Bailey says, we saw it as a toleration of independence by act of parliament before the presbytery was established. And so you've got this whole conflict going on now amongst these great men. Jeremiah Burroughs, one of the independents, part of the Westminster divines as well. He preached a sermon before the Lords at Westminster and both pleaded and warned not to force the people's consciences in this way. He said that to try and force, he used the illustration, he said you can drive a nail into rotten wood, but he says you take these good hard oak trees that we grow in England and you try and hammer a nail into the center of that. He says that nail's going to bend or it's going to break. It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And then we, the English people, have consciences that are as firm and set and as hard as those oak trees. So in that sense you're saying, you know, don't go there. Oliver Cromwell also wrote from the battlefield after, you know, the victorious battlefield when he won the battle, and he wrote to the Speaker of the House of Commons saying, "Honest men served you faithfully in this action. Sir, they are trusty. I beseech you in the name of God not to discourage them. He that ventures his life for liberty of his country, I wish he trust God for the liberty of his conscience, and you for the liberty he fights for." As Jeremiah Burroughs had also said, he had said, "Look here, guys, we've just fought to be delivered from the oppression of our consciences being forced into some kind of way of how to worship. We're not talking about fundamental doctrines, and you know, don't repeat the same thing." Now, after Charles handed himself over to the Scottish army, these Covenanters urged him to subscribe to the terms of the covenant and return to his throne. He refused. They pleaded, promising that their flag would lead the forces of Scotland in his support. He still refused. They prayed and entreated him with tears to accept the covenant and continue his reign. He would not. And so there was nothing left for them to do but to deliver him up to the English army. And so that's what they did. They handed him over and they left, went back to Scotland. And we'll see that as we continue there. We'll stop there for today, but as we continue, you will see that the Covenanters constantly interceded for Charles throughout this whole trial that would take place in England, and asked them not to execute him. So they weren't quite seeing the king's a violation of law in the same light that the English Parliament were at this time. For whatever reason, I'm not sure, but that's just how it is.